Thanks, Sharon. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
There is a handout for today's session, so if you haven't got one, it would be a good idea to...
It's a different one from yesterday.
And just to say that there's a fair bit of technical material in the handout, so don't be sort of overwhelmed by that. It's really just kind of like a reference that you can read at your leisure, but we will be making some reference to the handout as well. Sawubona. 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 Very good. That is the standard greeting in isiZulu, one of the African indigenous languages where I live. Sawubona. It's how you greet people. And the word literally means, I see you. Isn't that a cool way to say hello? I see you. Imagine for a moment how different our world would be if that were true of every encounter that every person had with another. If every time we encountered somebody, we were able to say, not just with our lips, but as a true expression of what is happening, I see you. Just imagine how different our world would be. Of course, we know that that's not how it goes within this world. We are very quick to look at the surface of who people are and to assume that that describes the totality of them. We're very quick to assign labels. Think of some of the labels that we commonly use. Liberal or conservative. Republican or Democrat. Christian or Muslim. Black or white. Male or female. Some of these are descriptors, but often they move beyond just description to limiting the capacity for really seeing. And when we allow these often arbitrary labels to define the limits of our sight, that can truly become diabolical, in the sense of pulling people apart. My own country bears painful testimony to a story where the color of a person's skin defined the limits of sight. And so as we think about our place in the world, and as we think about the sacred task that is ours to be engaging with others, the importance of seeing and seeing people beyond the normal arbitrary limits that would define our seeing, that truly is a sacred task. And particularly for those of us who understand our primary and deepest and most fundamental identity as being children of the living God, made in God's image, and sharing that image with every other human being. That one of our tasks is to see, or to attempt to see, in the way in which God does. And so, this morning, I want to suggest that the challenge of seeing more deeply is one that we need to actually feel, even though that can sometimes be quite uncomfortable. And as we consider what it means to see as God sees, so we are called to move beyond the entrenched assumptions that are often ours in those that we encounter. You see, there's pretty much more to pretty much everything than what first meets the eye. I experienced this in quite a cool way. I spent some time in Tampa, in Florida, a couple of years back. And I don't know if you guys know that part of Florida, but just across Tampa Bay is the city of St. Pete, St. Petersburg. And in St. Pete's, there is the Dali Museum. I don't know if any of you have visited the museum. It is well worth it. And so I was told that this is a place you've got to go and see. And so off I went. I wasn't hugely familiar I knew a little bit about Salvador Dali. I have to be honest, I didn't really fancy his art. It was kind of weird. And as it turns out, that was an opinion born entirely out of ignorance and prejudice. And when I went to the Dali Museum and actually took the time to look a little bit more deeply, I was totally blown away. And I want to show you one particular artwork of his. And it's this particular piece, which is in the museum. And there was a guide who was kind of taking us through. The guide was saying, well, this is a picture that Dali is painting of his wife, known as Gala, as she is looking through, it's called Gala Contemplating the Mediterranean. And she's looking through what looks like almost a keyhole onto the Mediterranean. But the interesting thing is that the perspective that Dali gives to us, if you can see what looks like a sun in that top left corner, if we just zoom in a little bit more, if it's in fact an image of Christ upon the cross, but looking down upon Christ from heaven. So as it were, God's perspective. And so there's a sense in which Dali is giving us God's perspective. As Gala is looking through this keyhole out onto the Mediterranean. And I was quite intrigued. I was quite fascinated. And then the guide said the most bizarre thing. She said, oh, and by the way, this is a portrait of Abraham Lincoln. And I thought, you're absolutely nuts. And so I went up come on, get out of here. So I went up and looked at the title of the painting, and sure enough, it's actually called Gala Contemplating the Mediterranean, which at 20 meters becomes a portrait of Abraham Lincoln. And so we were then invited to walk backwards about 20 meters. Now, we can't quite do that here because we're all sitting. But what I'll do is we'll just zoom out a little. And also, if you want to, maybe scrunch up your eyes. So scrunch up your eyes. Maybe take off your glasses if you've got glasses on.
Oh, my God.
Can you see it? So if you can't quite see it, scrunch up your eyes. Can you guys see it? Or take off your glasses. And so as you walk back 20 meters, suddenly what before was this picture of Gala contemplating the Mediterranean becomes the image of Abraham Lincoln. I mean, just genius. I mean, Dali's absolute genius. And it stayed with me, that experience. That is this God's perspective, who is able to see the detail of our circumstances and lives, but that there's more to pretty much everything than what first meets the eye. And that there's often another perspective, there's another vantage point, there's another whole reality that is contained within each one of our stories that God sees, and that we are called to see ourselves. Now, this is true within our lives, but I think it's also particularly true as we come to the sacred task of reading Scripture. Because when it comes to the reading of Scripture, it's seldom that we are actually able to say of the characters and the stories and the narratives that are there, Sawubona, I see you. Because there are also labels that we quickly are drawn to, and interpretations and assumptions and conclusions that can limit the extent of our seeing. And so one of the tasks of critical biblical engagement is to look again at the text with the recognition that there's more to pretty much everything than what first meets the eye. And that when we are able to hold sometimes the ambiguities of seeing first in one way, but then in another, we are in fact seeing as God sees. And so hopefully today, we can experience just a little of that as we look at the fascinating story of a character in the book of Job, his wife, who has seldom truly been seen. You know, if you were to be making a movie of the book of Job, you're going to have a hard time finding any leading female actors who would offer themselves for the part of Job's wife. You can save on your budget in terms of Angelina Jolie is not going to be lining up for this part, because hers is hardly an illustrious role. She appears for just 2 verses. She speaks just 6 words in the original Hebrew. Hers is the shortest speaking part in the entire book. Even the arbitrary messengers who bring Job the news of the calamities that have befallen him are given more airtime than Job's wife. She appears for 2 verses, she speaks 6 words, and then she vanishes from the text, never to be heard from again. Hardly what you'd call an illustrious role. And as a consequence of that, or as a consequence of that surface appearance of Job's wife, she has largely been ignored. Or the ways in which she has been seen has been in a very narrow and limited way. She has largely been vilified in the history of reception, because the words she speaks to Job are these: "Do you still persist in your integrity? Curse God and die." And so she's seen as somebody who's inciting Job to abandon his faith. A faithless wife, and so she gets roundly dissed. Is that a word that you use in America? Cool. She gets roundly dissed in the history of interpretation. Augustine called her the devil's assistant. John Chrysostom and Thomas Aquinas said that the reason why she didn't perish when Job's children all were destroyed was because the devil wanted to save her with which to use her to afflict Job more grievously. So he was kind of holding her back in order to kind of have another go at Job. Calvin called her Satan's tool. And certainly within the history of interpretation, that has largely described the way in which she's been seen. She's been seen overwhelmingly from a negative point of view. There are other interpretive traditions. We'll come to those in a moment. But yesterday, we had opportunity to look at William Blake's exposition of the book of Job. And I know there are some here who weren't here yesterday. But just to recap very, very briefly, the argument was made that Blake's exposition seeks to describe Job's journey of transformation, or a journey of disillusionment, from a picture or a paradigm of God, an understanding of faith that was essentially flawed and false, from which he needed to be liberated, to a new understanding of God. And within Blake's imagination, as he charts this journey of Job's transformation, I don't know if you noticed, for those of you who were here yesterday, but Blake has a very, very interesting take on Job's wife's place and prominence in that journey. I don't know if you noticed yesterday. In the biblical text, she appears for just two verses. In Blake's exposition, her presence is pervasive throughout all of it. Of the 21 illustrations, in 18 of them, his wife is present. Let's just very quickly run through the first slide, the second slide. Job's wife sitting next to Job. As they hear news of the calamities, she sits next to him, wringing her hands. This is the fifth slide. As Satan afflicts Job's body with boils, his wife is at his feet. When the comforters, the friends, come to lament with Job, his wife is there. When he cries out in chapter 3, "Let the day perish wherein I was born," she's there. And so it continues throughout the illustrations. His wife is there, she's there, she's there. In the whirlwind speeches, she's present. She hears, she witnesses what Job witnesses. She's a silent companion. We do well to remember that just because someone may be silent does not mean that they are absent. And so, as a consequence of Blake's, you can go and have a look at your handouts from yesterday. She's there in 18 of them, I promise you. As a consequence of Blake's imaginative take of recognizing that in fact Job's wife didn't just appear for two verses and then is gone, but remained present throughout his journey, it invites us to go back to the text. To be saying, can we look a bit more deeply beyond the surface of just those two words, to be recognizing her place and her pervasive presence and her influence. Within the handout, there's a section, and again, I'm sorry if some of it is a little bit technical, but there's a section on page 2 which offers... Does anybody upstairs, do you guys need handouts? Are we finished with them? Okay, great. Does anybody still there? So there are one or two extras floating on. Anybody need? Are you guys good? You're good. Okay, I think we're great. Thanks, Jim. there's a little section there in which I... just talk about what's called a behind-the-text reading. And a behind-the-text reading seeks to go behind the text to the world behind the text, to the socio-political and socio-cultural world undergirding the text. And that's not a simple task in the book of Job, because the text itself is resistant to being located in any particular historical, even geographical location. That's part of the design of the text. But it would seem that there are some clues within the text that suggest that reading the text with the behind-the-text lens of the agrarian economy of pre-monarchic Israel would make sense in terms of how Job's life and world is described within the text. And if we take that as an assumption, the agrarian economy of pre-monarchic Israel, we're talking around about 1200 to 1000 BCE, then some of the insights from scholars and studies of life within that particular milieu can be helpful in terms of bringing out some of the roles that men and women would have occupied within the domestic economy of that sort of context. And what's fascinating is that the assumption that this early Israelite society was a patriarchal assumption, in fact, is one that can be rigorously challenged. There's much that is patriarchal within the biblical text of the Old Testament, of course. But when we penetrate behind the text to the world of pre-monarchic Israel, the assumption that this was a patriarchal society, in fact, can be rigorously challenged. That there was a prominent place for women within that society as a function of absolute economic necessity. And we don't have time to get into all of the detail and nuance of that, but simply put, life was precarious in terms of it was tough going. As you look around at Holden Village, off the grid, it requires a village to run the village. Isn't that so? It requires many hands to be involved in order for even the basic stuff of this village to operate. How much more so within the society of that time? Precarious in many, many ways. Issues such as water security, a critical feature. Food security, a critical feature. The labor intensivity of the economy, of the agrarian economy, and therefore the necessity of large families, because a large family represented a larger labor force. And so as one considers all of this, the role and the importance and the prominence of women within that society, in fact, was far greater than what is often commonly acknowledged. And so when we read about a couple of things out of Job's experience, notably his wealth, we read in chapters 1, the first couple of verses, that he was a man of considerable wealth, 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 donkeys, 500 oxen, a great many servants. Within that agrarian economic milieu, the fact that wealth would have been able to have been developed and produced points to the presence and influence of Job's wife. Similarly, his social status. We read in, and I've got some references here, he was the greatest of all the men in the East, chapters 4, when Elihu speaks, acknowledges Job's significance. And then in chapter 29, very importantly, it's an important passage, Job speaks about his role within the public square, and his role in terms of as an advocate of justice for the poor and the marginalized within the city, and the respect that he was accorded within the city. And again, within the activities of that time, the key activities of procreation, production, and protection that were shared amongst men and women, the fact that Job was able to engage in the tasks of protection, which was not only about warfare, but also about the just ordering of society, was a consequence of him being freed to do so because of what was happening within the domestic space. So let's not get too bogged down in all of that, but the point that I'm essentially seeking to be making is that arising out of Blake's imagination to be seeing Job's wife as present throughout the text, we can see hints within the text itself as we look at Job's wealth, his social status, and of course his children, because presumably for Job to have children, there needed to be a wife and a mother involved. Not just up front in the prologue, but also at the end of the book in the epilogue. And so even at that level, there are already indications within the text. Hang on a moment. We dismiss Job's wife too quickly at our peril. Hers is a more pervasive presence. Okay, so now The central thesis that I'd want to suggest today is that this journey of transformation that Blake describes, that Job's wife is a key catalyst in that journey. That it wasn't simply his suffering that thrust Job onto this journey, but it was the role of his wife in her response to his suffering that played a critical part. And so I'm going to just try to make that case, and then we can maybe bat that around a little today. And again, just to remind us from what was spoken about yesterday and why it matters that Job goes on the journey of transformation that he does. It matters because the God you serve determines the person you are. I shared a story from James Michener that made that point. In similar vein, Peter's story, I don't know if any of you know Peter, for those of you who know Alan, it's Alan's dad. Peter's story is a former bishop and leader within the Methodist Church of Southern Africa. Right through the days of apartheid, one of the key activists and one of our nation's true prophets, served as a professor of Christian ministry at Duke Divinity School. He's now retired. But while he was out in the States, he had opportunity to lead a congressional civil rights pilgrimage to Birmingham, Alabama, with a bunch of congressmen and senators. And as part of the pilgrimage, they were visiting a whole lot of churches that were part of the story of the civil rights struggle. And some of the congressmen, the younger congressmen and senators, were muttering and mumbling about all of this time spent in churches. Presumably it was a novel experience for them, I don't know. And Peter replied that, as was the case in apartheid South Africa, the church in the civil rights movement played a critical part, not simply as offering sanctuary and space for many of the gatherings, but also through the way in which the church informed much of the ideology. And of course, Dr. King, of course, himself was of course a pastor and a preacher. And so Peter was making the point about how the church played its influence within the civil rights movement in terms of shaping much of the ideology and the vision of those who were engaged in that movement. And then somebody piped up, but what about Bull Connor? Bull Connor was the notorious sheriff or public safety commissioner of Birmingham. He was the guy who put on the turned the attack dogs and the fire hoses onto protesting students. I mean, if you remember that part of the story. And so the question was asked, well, what about Bull Connor? Because he was a staunch Christian, a committed churchgoer, a staunch Methodist, I believe. Clearly not a Lutheran, okay? He wouldn't have put the fire hoses on. But he was somebody who was in church. And it was a good question. And then Bill Press, the CNN journalist who was covering the pilgrimage, he said, I suppose it depends on whose God is God. It's a reminder again that the picture of God that we have influences pretty much everything. And of course, in reply to the question, whose God is God, we respond by saying, mine, of course. or maybe ours. But we must be careful about rushing too quickly to that answer. The nature of religious conviction is such that it doesn't yield easily to self-critique. That our very convictions, religious convictions, in a sense, protect themselves from the critique in terms of the validity and legitimacy of those convictions. And so as we recognize the importance of this journey of transformation from paradigms of faith and pictures of God that are ultimately inadequate to those which are life-giving and expansive and inclusive and inviting, sometimes we need those who can see us in ways that we can't see ourselves. And often what is required is a disruption. Now, the experience of suffering often provides such a disruption. And I suppose that was true of Job. But it's a little bit more nuanced than that. And so I'm not sure if people have got Bibles with them. And I should have mentioned, it doesn't matter if you don't. Just by the way, for the session tomorrow, it would be helpful. And I know that there are Bibles out there. It's not the most critical thing for right now, Sharon. So let's not be unduly constrained. But a close narrative reading of the prologue, the first two chapters of Job, suggests that the necessary disruption that was required to begin to thrust Job on a new trajectory or on a new journey, that necessary disruption occurs not through the suffering that he experiences, but through his wife. Let me make the case. The prologue unfolds according to a very clear pattern. And it's a clear narrative technique. And it's a pattern of alternating scenes between earth and heaven. And much of what happens within these scenes is mirrored in subsequent scenes. Sometimes quite directly and explicitly in terms of the words that are used, but also in terms of the sequence of the sorts of events that happen. And so the first five verses of chapter 1, we have a scene on earth in which Job is introduced in terms of his great estate, that he has 10 children, all of these cattle and livestock, and he's described as this man of great piety. He was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. And then we read about how Job's children used to like to party it up, probably on the occasion of the birthdays of the brothers, and they would have a big shindig. And while that was happening, Job was very anxious because he had a very controlled way of operating, and so he would offer preemptive sacrifices on behalf of his children. And the very first words that he says are these: "It may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." So that's the first scene. And then we break away to a scene in heaven between God and this character called Hasatan, in which God points out Job's piety. He says, have you noticed my servant Job? Like, Lord, what you doing? You're drawing the attention. And he says, yeah, he's like, nobody's like him, blameless and upright. And the Satan says, yeah, but it's just because you've put a hedge around him. You know, it's easy when things are going well to kind of serve God. Take that away, and you'll see he'll curse you. And so kind of a wager is set up. And God says, okay, just don't, you can't touch him. And then we move from verse 13 back to a scene on earth where the calamities happen, one after another. Messengers come to Job with the news. Your cattle have been captured. The fire from heaven has fallen. The wind of God has come, and the house where your children was at has been, all your kids are dead, kind of one after another. And Job responds with words of remarkable piety. Naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And we read, in all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrongdoing. Let me go back to heaven. And it's almost an absolute replica of the first scene in heaven. And the way in which the text unfolds, it's almost a duplication. And God says the same thing. Have you seen Job, my servant? Hey, in spite of what he did, he's still like holding on to his integrity. And the Satan says, yeah, but you know, touch his body. Different story. So you can see there's a pattern. And then we move back to the earth again. And Job gets afflicted with boils and sores all over his body. And so the pattern has been set up. And so what we expect is, as has happened in the first round, we expect Job to now respond with words of piety, saying, well, this is just how it is. That's what's being set up. But instead of that, there's a disruption. And instead of that, Job's wife now speaks. Notice she doesn't speak after her children have been killed. There's remarkable restraint within her in terms of speaking out then. It waits until this moment, and it essentially interrupts the narrative flow. And so the sequence of scenes between earth and heaven and earth and heaven and earth, and you'd expect to then go back to heaven where God would then say, yeah, you see, he's passed the test. That never happens. And so within a narrative understanding of the prologue, the insertion of the words of Job's wife represents a disruption. And then Job speaks, and he says these words. Verse 10, he said to her, you speak as any foolish woman would speak. Husbands, quick note, this would not be one of those texts that you need to be taking to heart in the way in which you engage with your wife, okay? You speak as any foolish woman would speak. Shall we not receive good at the hand of God and not receive bad? And then we read these words. In all this, Job did not sin, which is a reflection of what the conclusion of chapter 1 is. But it's changed. In all this, Job did not sin with his lips. And so the rabbis suggest that maybe something is beginning to happen within him. He has the right words. Shall we not receive good at the hand of God and not also the bad? And in all this, he did not sin with his lips. It suggests that something is beginning to happen within him, within his mind and his consciousness. And thereafter, he sits in silence. The friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, come for 7 days. 7 days and seven nights, which is kind of like an echo of the creation story in Genesis 1. And it suggests that what might be created or recreated within him. And as a consequence of that disruption, occasioned by the words of his wife, the book kind of explodes as Job, in chapter 3, launches forth in cursing the day of his birth, which then triggers this round of dialogical engagement between Job and the friends that finally breaks down in futility. And then there's some other stuff, another character, Elihu, enters the scene. We don't have to worry about that until finally God speaks in the divine speeches. So what I'm curious about, and what I'd like us to explore, then would be these words, these six words that Job's wife utters, that occasions this disruption and begins to thrust him on this new journey. But before we get into that, I'm suddenly realizing that I'm talking a hell of a lot here. So let me push pause And maybe just to open up some space in terms of any comments or observations, in terms of any of that that's been presented thus far, before we dive into the actual words of Job's wife and ways in which they can be heard and read. Are there any comments or observations in terms of, or critiques? You don't have to agree with what I'm saying, of course. But if anybody would like to offer anything at this point, it'd be great to hear from you. Yes,
John. Can you talk about her loss of status along with his? Because I presume how she was viewed in the community would be reflected in his standing.
Absolutely, absolutely. And in fact, there are extra-biblical accounts. So the Septuagint, for example, the Greek version of the Old Testament, adds and embellishes the story and talks about some of the consequences for Job's wife in terms of the suffering that was hers. And then there's a work called The Testament of Job, a Jewish work from around about the first century, which is obviously related to the story of Job, in which his wife is a woman by the name of Sitidos. We don't need to get into all of this now, but within the Testament of Job, the consequences for her are spelt out in a compelling way. As Job sits on the ash heap in his misery, she's the one that actually gets on with kind of trying to care for him after they've lost everything. She's the one who goes to try to secure bread to feed him and to care for him, to the extent that she then even cuts off her hair in the public square and sells it in order to get bread for Job. Which, as we would hear with our 21st century ears, is like a pretty, like, amazing thing that this wife was so devoted. But within that context, the cutting of a woman's hair in public would have been a deeply shameful thing, which sounds harsh to our ears because it was motivated by her desire to care for him. So it's a lovely example of filling in the gaps the biblical text leaves open in terms of what this would have meant for her and the social consequence, not just the economic consequence, but the social consequence of what had happened. And so within another of the interpretive traditions, you know, the first was just basically seeing Job's wife in a very negative light. She was just trying to get Job to abandon his faith. There's another tradition that recognizes that she has also got a story of suffering and hardship to tell. This was her loss too. These were also her children that had been killed. And so do we need to hear her words in the light of that? So yes, absolutely, there would have been consequences for her. That would have arisen. Yes?
Considering Job's wealth, is it likely in this culture that he would have had only one wife? And since this story posits that, is that significant?
Right, and so it's a great question. And again, all that we can work with is what the text gives us. Now, within the Testament of Job that I've just referenced, when Job is restored and has further children, it's with a second wife. But there's a text from the first century by a guy by the name of Pseudo-Philo, Liber Antiquatum Biblicarum. Don't quote me on that, okay? Something like that. But you wouldn't know if I'm basically, you know, talking nonsense or not. And in that text, it's quite explicit that it was the same wife who has the 10 children in the beginning and then another 10 children at the end. So the idea that Job then has another wife, a second wife, as in the Testament of Job, is quite explicitly rebuffed. And the rabbis, in fact, identified Job's wife as Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, who gets raped by Shechem. We're going to be looking at Dinah's story tomorrow in terms of the connection with Job's wife. So yes, yours is a very valid observation in terms of there may well have been, Job may well have had additional wives, but the text doesn't actually open the door to that speculation as such. It is his wife that is presented, and so we, in a sense, need to work with that. Yes, Bob.
So in the epilogue, there's no mention of his wife.
Right.
And if those were 10 additional children, might that, was it a restoration of the original children, or was it 10 children by another woman that might suggest another wife?
Right. And so that's exactly where the Testament of Job goes. Different wife, new children. Pretty much there were further children born to Job. So it's, and I know that we kind of feel like it's a bit of a cheap parting shot, you know, how can you replace, you know, replacing cattle and sheep, and oh, well, it's just, he had 10 children, he has 10 more, you know, doesn't have to, you know, all's fine. I mean, you can't replace children. I mean, but again, the children in the epilogue is a key part of the text that points to the presence of Job's wife, even though there's a silence around that. And so, of course, there would have had to been a wife and a mother involved in terms of further children being born to Job. I don't know if that really answers where you were going with the question, but that would be my take. Yeah.
Yes. Just for clarification, if I heard you correctly, which I may not have, that the epilogue, prelude and the epilogue are out of the agrarian time, pre-monarchical.
Right.
The text of the dialogue, though, when you were talking about Job in chapter 29 and his care for the poor and the needy and all of that, sounds much more monarchical or
right.
Prophetic.
Right, yeah.
So you're dealing primarily then with the prelude and the epilogue and the story of Job itself is out of a different period of time.
Absolutely. Wonderful and, awesome insight that. And so, let me be clear, I'm not making a case in terms of where we locate the book of Job and the text of Job in terms of any particular historical moment. But what I'm saying is that the lens of the agrarian economy of pre-monarchic Israel is a helpful one to consider the possibilities of the role of women in particular in Job's wife quite specifically. So I'm not wanting to say any more than that or make any further claim than that in terms of where the text may be located historically. Yeah. But yeah, wonderful, wonderful recognition and insight that does point to the emergence of the city, which of course was a development within the monarchical period. Any other quick comments, questions at this stage? I find this stuff quite interesting. I hope I'm not boring the hell out of you. Shall we then have a look at the words of Job's wife? And so they are found in Job 2, verse 9. And so in the Hebrew, there are just six words that she speaks. Othecha machazik, bethumathecha, barek Elohim vamuth. And there are a couple of words within, so just six words, but it's a speech that's filled with ambiguity. And I want us just to, we could spend time on each of these words and how they work, but I want us to spend time with just one or two of them. And the first would be the root, tuma, which is commonly translated integrity. And certainly as the NRSV translates it, do you still persist in your integrity? And there's some notes in the handout around this. I'm sure we'd agree that integrity is a value, is a concept that we would ascribe a very positive value to. That integrity is a good thing. And that would be, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find somebody to say, oof, that's personal integrity. And that's kind of as a bit of a, in a pejorative way. And rightly so, what we understand by the word integrity. But when we go to the Hebrew root, and certainly that would be some of the association with the Hebrew root, the root, tav mem mem, has the sense of conveying that which is complete, what's blameless, what's just, honest, perfect, peaceful, without defect. Again, overwhelmingly a positive associations. It's a word that has very important, an important place in the book of Job, because almost all of its derivatives in both nominative and adjectival forms occur within the text of Job. And so in the very first verse, when we read this description of Job, there was once a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. That man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. We find that word blameless, it comes from this root. And this becomes the premise in terms of who Job is. God is acknowledging of that. And so Job is blameless. His life of devotion is one that is without blemish. And there's an But what's fascinating about the distribution of this word in the book of Job is that it occurs within the prologue and then within the cycle of speeches. And I've given, I think, some of the distribution of that. 18 times in the book as a whole, which is a significant number. When scholars kind of do this work and track words like this, it's a significant number. But the distribution of this term, when once you get to the divine speeches, this idea of integrity or this idea of perfection, this idea of blamelessness, of wholeness. In fact, when Job speaks his very final soliloquy, which finishes at the end of chapter 31, we read in the NRSV, the words of Job are ended. But that word that's translated ended, it's actually it's using this root. It's like the words of Job are now finally complete. Once we get to the divine speeches, the word disappears from the text completely. And it's a word that has particular association within the cultic sacrificial worship of Israel, particularly within the priestly tradition. You were required to bring a sacrifice that was without blemish, that was blameless, same root. And so as we see Job's entire religious apparatus and his entire approach in terms of the sacrificial worship that was his, and the fact that he's a blameless person, it would suggest that Job is blameless, that he was tam, to use the Hebrew word, because of that his life was tamim, without blemish. And yet when we get to the divine speeches, that category within the moral universe of the text kind of is, just doesn't appear. It's like that the Lord of the divine speeches is not concerned about what's perfect and what's without blemish and what's blameless. That this is not, in fact, God's concern. It's Job's religious concern. It's the friend's religious concern, saying, no, you can't be blameless because of what's happened to you. And so this word that is translated as integrity, with the positive associations that we have with that, and the ways in which it's used within the first part of the book, is always with a positive sense, with one exception: the way in which it's used by Job's wife. And so we maybe need to search for another word other than integrity to get a sense of what she might be preaching towards. That is, she's saying, do you still persist in is it integrity? Or is it your sense of needing everything to be perfect, needing everything to be blameless, needing everything to be ordered, needing everything to be just right, and to be seeing yourself within that, and to be sacrificing on behalf of your children in case maybe they've cursed God in their hearts? Are you still persisting in this whole understanding of what it means to be in relationship with God? Are you still persisting in is it integrity or is it self-righteousness? Are you still persisting in, is it integrity or is it your toxic religious fundamentalism? And if we hear it in that sense, which I acknowledge is a kind of a reading against the grain of how the word is commonly used, then all of a sudden, something opens up in terms of what Job's wife is seeking to disrupt. Do you still persist in your toxic religious fundamentalism? Curse God and die. Now, when she says curse God and die, the word that's used there is barek Elohim, famous. It literally means bless. She doesn't say curse God and die, she says bless God and die. And in fact, within the prologue, we encounter this word 7 times. And sometimes it means bless, and sometimes it means curse. Whenever you see the word curse in the prologue, 1:5, it may be that my children have cursed God in their hearts. The word actually used is bless. But it's been used euphemistically because you wouldn't want to talk about cursing God. And so the word bless is used in the same way. I'm trying to think of an example now, but it's just escaping me, so let me move on. When the Satan says to God, he will surely curse you to your face, the word that's used is bless. Again, used euphemistically. Clearly meant euphemistically. When Job says, blessed be the name of the Lord, the word used there is the same word, but clearly in that sense, meaning blessing. And so within the prologue, we encounter this particular word, and we've got to navigate the sense. Does it mean bless? Does it mean curse? And in most of the instances, it's clear, except when we come to the speech of Job's wife. Is she calling him to curse God, the God of this toxic religious fundamentalism, to actually renounce this God? That would be a particular reading. Or is she saying, if you persist in your toxic religious fundamentalism, in blessing this God, in fact, you're going to die? Because when you bow down to a false God, death is always a consequence. We see that in our world. We see that in the toxic expressions of religious fundamentalism. And so we have to navigate the meaning of this particular word. And so as a consequence of all of this, we find ourselves confronted with a whole range of different ways in which the words of Job's wife can be interpreted. And so I've put on the back page of the handout 8 different options. There are, in fact, others in the ways in which her words have been interpreted. From the sort of the traditional way, which is number 1, of inciting or tempting Job to abandon his faith, to others. And we're going to land in a moment on number 8, the exposure of Job's toxic religious fundamentalism. And there's kind of like an amplified paraphrase of the words of Job's wife that I offer there as a way of trying to unpack this particular interpretation. But maybe let's just take a moment to push pause and to, well, let's just very, very briefly, again, I'm talking too much. Let's very briefly have a look at some of these varying interpretations of the words of Job's wife. The first one would be, I guess, the most common and traditional one, that she was tempting Job to abandon his faith. And that's why she gets dismissed as a faithless wife. Another way of reading her words could be the bitter and blaming outburst of a grief-stricken mother and wife. So again, like a negative reading of her, but it's like saying, well, can you blame her? The audacity that you, of all people, still insist that you're a man of integrity. Let me tell you what real integrity means here. For you to face up to the truth of your guilt and accept the consequences of your shameful wrongdoing, this interpretation, Job's wife is siding with the friends. Clearly, you've done something wrong here, Job. I dare you to call down the wrath of God upon you, that your life might be like that of our children, as you rightly deserve. Whew. She's steamed up. That would be one interpretation. Or it could be an interpretation to encourage Job to end his pain, that this is the utterance of actually a loving wife who can see the absolute agony of her husband. And the only way out, she's advocating a form of theological euthanasia. Curse God and die. Be done with it. This pain is too much for you. A more compassionate response. Maybe it's a way that she's seeking to encourage Job to maintain his integrity to the end. In spite of everything that has happened, I can see that you've managed to hold fast to your faith and your integrity remains uncompromised. Don't give up now. Continue to bless God right up to the very end. And then you can die in peace. And you feel a very different reading. A woman by the name of Claire McGuinness offers this intriguing possibility that she's playing the devil's advocate. She sees Job in the shock of what has so suddenly befallen him, sitting on the fence. Whether he'll bless God or curse God, that's the question. And so she presents this blasphemous position of cursing God, not because it's the position she wants Job to take, but because she knows that once she verbalizes it, once this position is held out to Job by another as an option, he will refuse it. She takes a calculated risk concerning what kind of response such an outrageous suggestion will evoke. She says what she does to provoke him to take publicly, as it were, precisely the opposite position. She verbalizes the option of cursing God so that Job will not. And then maybe it could be interpreted as advocating martyrdom as an act of resistance and protest against God's injustice. Your integrity is clearly beyond reproach, yet look at how you've been treated with such monstrous injustice. Instead of being blessed as you deserve, you've been cursed by God, who has violated the order of things by punishing you for no reason. Now this is what God deserves, for the punishment should fit the crime. To be cursed. Instead of blessing God, curse him. This is what your integrity demands. And when you die, your innocent death will be a witness against him. Whew. Kind of a real sort of activist protest. Recognizing God's culpability. The resentment of Job's faith. Are you still holding on so desperately to your precious integrity? Can you not see that it's a sham, blinding you to the truth of what's really going on here? But sure, carry on, knock yourself out, Job. continue blessing your brutish God, and then you might as well die, because with this kind of faith, you're as good as dead anyway. It's leading towards this idea of maybe the issue is the faith that he's holding, which comes then to an interpretation that I guess I've been trying to work towards in this presentation, the exposure of Job's toxic religious fundamentalism. Let me read it. And so this is an amplified paraphrase of her words. Are you still attached to your toxic religious fundamentalism, which you've interpreted as integrity and have assumed will guarantee your security? Can you not see the poverty and futility of such a worldview? It's a way of seeing the world that is imprisoning you, preventing you from truly experiencing life in all its complexity. Let it go. Instead, do the craziest thing imaginable. Dare to renounce the God that is the object of your faith, who has become your jailer. Yes, curse this false God. I know that it will feel like a death, but do not be afraid. It's a necessary form of dying so that a new, authentic, and transformed self might emerge that will be capable of seeing in exciting new ways the truth of God, the world, and our place within it. Sorry, that was kind of quite heavy going, oh, I've forgotten something, but that's fine. Just remind me before we close, I'm going to show you one more image. It's kind of quite fun. But let me hear. So of those interpretations, that last one, of course, squares firmly with what Blake is seeking to do in his illustrations of this journey from a false form of faith to a transformed and living form of faith. And I'm not sure, yeah, any comments or pushback or questions or observations that anyone would like to offer? Yes.
I guess I see it as an echo of kind of the Garden of Eden, where Adam says, "Lord God, the woman you gave me." It's like she's not taking any acceptance for anything. She's distancing herself, saying, "You're the one that sinned. I had no part of this. You're all to blame." Kind of like she's, it's all you. I have nothing to do with this.
Are you hearing that in Job's wife, in the way in which you hear her words? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. And so if we hear her words in that right, in that light, then there could then very definitely be a critique in terms of to what extent is she party to this?
Right.
Of course, the way in which the wager has been set up, it is because of Job's life and piety that the wager is set up. She isn't included in that, but that's certainly a valid observation and comment. Thank you. Yes, what?
I'm absolutely intrigued about the usage of curses.
Sorry, I missed that.
I'm intrigued with your use of the word for curse and bless.
Right.
In verse 21 of chapter 1, Job says, "Naked I came forth from my mother's womb, and naked shall I go back again. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And if she says, "Bless God and die," she's in effect saying, "Carry out this idea of your God."
Right.
You know, so that if this is the God you confess, then bless him and die.
Right.
So she exposed by him not doing that, she exposes his toxicity.
Yeah.
His fundamentality. He's hanging on to something different than actually what he's confessing.
Right. So you could read her, the ambiguity of Barek, where the bless or curse, either way within this reading that exposes his toxic faith. Either curse your God, be done with this God, and die to this form of faith, or bless this God, continue to maintain this posture, and know that death, in fact, will be the result. So, yeah, you've got your finger on the pulse of that. Thank you. Yes.
I want to thank you for the perspective in the beginning, especially, but I think I've always seen the differences between different, you know, interpretations of the Bible as on a spectrum of fundamental to literal, or literal and fundamental to metaphorical. And I want to thank you for the perspective of detail versus looking at the whole versus the detail.
Right, okay.
I think that's going to be very helpful for me. Mm.
Thank you. Yes.
So one of the issues I face is the language of eisegesis versus exegesis, right. Where the former is where you read into the scripture, exo is where you pull from the scripture, and I'm uncertain. I mean, I'm persuaded by the 8 interpretations, and I'm uncertain about to what degree is that me, from my worldview and perspective, reading into a text, and how much of it is the text speaking to me this way.
Yeah. Absolutely, and of course, all of these would have their opponents on the basis of that, and so the conversation continues. I'm of the view, I mean, I teach Bible as part of what I do, that this idea of, you know, we've got to have exegesis, allow, you know, draw out from the text as opposed to eisegesis, reading into the text. I think that every reading of Scripture in some degree has an eisegetical component. We can't help but to be, and the question is, are we aware of that? That's the key thing. And so, absolutely, a lot of this could be our own projections. In fact, that's a very helpful segue. Let me show you one more image, which maybe it was fortuitous that I forgot to show it earlier, because it does kind of circle back to the whole Sauerborner idea. And it's a particular artwork by an artist by the name of Georges de la Tour that dates from the 1630s. And it's an interesting artwork because it was, for much of its existence, it's been shrouded in mystery. And in fact, the actual the fact that this was the artist was not known until, you know, quite late in the 20th century, when a cleaning of the canvas actually revealed his signature. But art critics entitled this painting "St. Peter Delivered from Prison by an Angel." So that was the title that was given to this work. And it was interpreted as, you know, St. Peter's in prison, and there's this angel that comes with compassion, holding a candle with this hand of compassion in this act of deliverance. But then in 1935, art critics then said, no, this is not a painting about St. Peter, but they identified it with Job. And you can see at the foot there is a broken pottery vase or bowl. And vase is what we call a vase in Africa. So this pottery, broken pottery bowl, on the strength of that, art critics say, no, this is actually a painting of Job and his wife. And so 2 years later, in 1937, it was then exhibited in Paris, but it was given a new title. No longer St. Peter Delivered from Prison by an Angel, but the title became Job Mocked by His Wife. And now, this hand that had been seen as a hand of compassion of an angel coming to deliver Peter from prison, same image, is now seen as a kind of hovering with some kind of threat or, you know, whatever. Isn't that interesting? And so on the strength of an understanding or of a way of seeing Job's wife, the art critics were saying, yeah, this would be the title of the painting, Job Mocked by His Wife. It's a lovely example of how the limits of sight can influence what we see. So maybe we can just leave it at that for today. I know we're about to go to lunch. Are there any comments or questions? We've got a few minutes, so any conversation? Yes, Maureen.
Isn't your title, Now My Eyes Have Seen You?
Oh, yes, thank you. Okay, thank you. So at the end of the divine speeches, in chapter 42, when Job responds to the revelation of God, he says, I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eyes have seen you. I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. And so this is Job's words in relation to God. The sense of it's kind of like this is Job's Sawubona moment of actually coming to see God. I see you. I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear. What does that mean? Was it just kind of, there'd been some kind of religious tradition there, but now Job has actually come to his own visionary insight. And so whilst that is what Job says of God, could it be the same words that could be said of his wife? And as a consequence of seeing her, as Blake imaginatively sees her in a new light, could we say, now my eyes have seen, I've seen you with the seeing of my eyes. And so now my ears hear you in terms of what it was that you actually were saying. So I was just playing on that particular text in terms of calling us to be seeing Job's wife in a new way.
Yes. So I have a son who has a real problem with God as portrayed in the prologue to Job.
Right.
And this talk has made me think about, well, maybe that view of who God is isn't what really God is.
Absolutely.
And it'll help me in discussing that whole, you know, who is God?
Yeah.
Is God really someone who would do this?
Thank you so much. You know, one of the things that scholars often look at is that in the book of Job, there seem to be different Jobs on display. In the prose, certainly in the prologue, in the dialogue, in his soliloquy, in his response to the divine speeches. But what's seldom recognized is that maybe there are different gods on display as well. That would certainly be my position. I think that the religious consciousness that we're talking about, that Job needs to be released of, is in fact a religious consciousness in which the Lord of the prologue is actually embroiled. And so the God of the divine speeches is a very different God of the prologue, at least. And so I think that case can be made. And in fact, there's a Carol Newsom. She's a biblical scholar. In my view, she's the fourth person of the Trinity. She's just like amazing. And she's written a book on Job where she looks at, I don't know if any of you are familiar with the sort of the literary theory of Mikhail Bakhtin, the Russian literary theorist. And he has a concept called, he talks about polyphonic texts, texts with many voices. And the idea is that in a polyphonic text, you've got different voices, different perspectives, and no one voice is privileged. And Carol Newsom has used that analysis to look at the book of Job. And to recognize that there are different voices within the book of Job, in the prologue, in the prose, in the dialogue, in the hymn to wisdom in chapter 28, the divine speeches, the epilogue, that these are different voices that are each articulating a different perspective. And the genius of the book of Job is that it seeks to hold these different voices together. Now, some would resonate with us more than others. For some people, the God of the prologue is like, yeah, we you know, that this is a God that kind of means business. For others, this is like a devil of a God. And so we've got to navigate this. So I would absolutely invite engagement around the idea that we have different gods on display. And the question is, and it's what Job is confronted with in the divine speeches, what is your view? And can there be an expansive idea in terms of even who God is, or especially who God is? That, I think, is one of the key questions that the book poses. So hopefully that's helpful as you engage that with your son and his struggle. Yes, Janetta.
So I took a class on Job in seminary, and I'm mixing all these different things up, but There was one play we read that was set at, during a program pre-World War II. Another one, which I want to say might be Elie Wiesel, is that Trial of God?
Right, yeah.
Does that take place in the concentration camp?
That's right,
before
yes.
Before they're being let out. So I,
and God is pronounced guilty.
Yeah. But the and man the, who's been the prosecutor, you know, is, so I'm looking at Job's wife, so like there's this both. He's the one that argues against God, that God is guilty, and yet calls the people to prayer and praises
right.
as they're being
yeah.
let out.
Yeah.
So yeah. both of those things even, like, do you persist in this? Arguing against maybe persisting in this idea of God, but then also turning to prayer.
Right.
You know, so it's,
right.
I feel like suddenly Job's wife is like the Mona Lisa or something. It's like, what is, this is great. I mean, I think this is wonderful.
Yeah. Sure. That's a, thank you. I mean, I haven't actually thought of that particular a connection in terms of that whole like lament form and how through that it kind of draws us back in relation to the speech of Job's wife. So thank you. That's a stunning insight. Mm-hmm. Really, really. Yes, Sharon.
So she's never named.
She's never named, yeah. And so sometimes, so in the Testament of Job, she's named. Citados or sometimes Citus. And then in the rabbinic tradition, she's identified with Dinah. But she's never named. So sometimes people want to come up. And so that's another interesting, and in fact, as part of what we're going to be looking at tomorrow, we're going to be looking at the whole sort of intersection of speech and silence and how sometimes silence can speak in ways that's more profound than what our speech can. So the fact that she remains unnamed kind of connects with that. Yeah.
I didn't hear why the experts changed their mind about this picture.
Right. So it was on the strength of actually identifying this pottery, broken pottery. You know, Job in chapter 2, when he gets afflicted with sores, he scrapes himself with a potsherd, a piece of broken pottery. That's part of the Job story. And so it was kind of like a detail of the painting that had been sort of overlooked. And so as they were looking at this, saying, no, is this St. Peter in prison? Well, what's this broken pot doing? Maybe, in fact, we've got it wrong and it's Job. And this is then Job and his wife. Well, it must be. Well, then, if it's his wife, well, then she's got to be mocking him because we know what his wife is like. You know, that's kind of how the thinking went.
Maybe bringing enlightenment.
Right.
Yeah, so exactly. So, I mean, so now there are others, by the way, that would reject that title and say, no, this is actually, this is Job's wife extending compassion to Job. Absolutely. I mean, that's certainly, I find it hard to actually reconcile the title Job mocked by his wife with what you see in the painting. But the point that I'm making is that that's what they did because of the limits of their seeing, because they'd assumed we know who Job's wife is. Mm-hmm. We've seen her. She's basically faithless. Therefore, she must be mocking Job.
Her
so.
Expression is much too kind.
Yeah, so we can see that. And so...
also saw it, right?
Sure, exactly, yeah. Anyhow, our time is just about gone. So thank you so much, everybody. And... quick thing for those who are going to be here and are planning on coming to the session tomorrow, it would be helpful for you to grab a Bible when you come in. We're going to be, it'll be important for you to have a text in front of you.